Good afternoon. I'd like to call this meeting of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order. The time is now 1:32 p.m. We're in Veltz, room 105. Today is Wednesday, March 11th, 2026. Members present are Senator Yount, Senator Gray Jackson, Senator Dunbar, and myself, Senator Bjorkman. Senator Merrick is up in finance right now. She may come down if they wrap up sooner than we do. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Welcome everyone to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please turn off or silence your cell phones and join me in extending a warm Senate Labor and Commerce welcome to our recording secretary, Carrie Tupo, and our LAO moderator, Chloe Miller. We have four items on our agenda today, so we are going to get to it. Under bills previously heard and scheduled, we will first take up two bills that get rid of funds, Senate Bill 263, Child Care Facility Loan Funds, and Senate Bill 264, repealing housing funds and accounts. These bills will be followed by an introduction of a committee substitute for Senate Bill 121, Health Insurance Allowable Charges, and a presentation by the University of Alaska Fairbanks on Engineering Alaska's Industrial Workforce. First up, from the esteemed Senator James Kaufman's office, we have Mr. Takuma Inoue to give us a brief recap of Senate Bill 263. Mr. Inoue, welcome back to Senate Labor and Commerce. We're glad you're here. Please begin your brief recap of the bill.
Thank you, Chair Bjorkman and members of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, Takuma Inoue, staffer to Senator James Kaufman. SB 263 is part of an effort to use the inactive state funds report by Legislative Finance Division to repeal unused and inactive state funds and accounts. 263 reveals an unused program and the accounts tied to it under the single subject of child care. Thank you. I'm happy to take questions. We also have Rob Carpenter from LFD available to answer any questions the committee may have.
Excellent. Mr. Carpenter, thank you for being available. Are there any questions from committee members? Hearing and seeing none, at this time we will open public testimony on Senate Bill 263. Is there anyone in the room or online who wishes to testify to this item? Seeing and hearing none, at this time we'll close public testimony on Senate Bill 263. Are there any further questions or comments on this piece of legislation from committee members? Hearing and seeing none, what are the wishes of the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move to report Senate Bill 263. Version 34-Lima Sierra 1443/A-alpha from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there any objection? Hearing no objection, Senate Bill 263, version 34-LS1443/A is in Anaktuvik, is reported from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. If we could just stay after the meeting, we'll sign all of our reports afterward. Next up, we'll roll right into Senate Bill 264. We also heard this bill on Monday when we had a presentation of the bill. Today, it is my intention, just like the bill before, to take public testimony and look to the will of the committee. Mr. Inoue, could you please provide a brief recap of Senate Bill 264?
Thank you, Chair Bjorkman. For the record, Takuma Inoue, staffer to Senator James Kaufman. Similarly, SB 264 is also part of that effort to use the inactive state funds report by LFD to repeal unused and inactive state funds and accounts. SB 264 repeals just unused funds and accounts under the single subject of housing. Thank you. I am happy to take questions, and we also have Rob Carpenter from LFD available for questions as well.
Very well. Are there any questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, at this time, we'll open public testimony on Senate Bill 264. Is there anyone in the public, online or in the room, who would like to testify to this item? Seeing and hearing none, at this time, we'll close public testimony on Senate Bill 264. Are there any questions or comments from committee members on Senate Bill 264? Seeing and hearing none, what are the wishes of the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move to report Senate Bill 264, version 34, Lima Sierra 1437/N like Nelchik from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there any objection? Hearing none, Senate Bill 264, version 34, LS 1437, /A, as in Nikolai, N as in Nikolai, is reported from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. We will sign the committee report at the end of the meeting. Mr. Inouye, thank you very much. We'll take a brief at ease while we set up for the next bill. It's 1:38 now. We're back in Belt's Room 105. Next up on our agenda is Senate Bill 121, Health Insurance Allowable Charges. Today it is my intention to hear a brief recap of the bill and adopt a proposed committee substitute brought to us by the bill sponsor and then set the bill aside for further consideration of that committee substitute. With us today, we have the Honorable Senator Kathy Geisel and her staff, Ms. Jane Conway, to give us a brief recap of the bill and present a CS. Senator, could you please put yourself on the record and give us the highlights of the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, this is Kathy Geisel. I am the senator for Senate District E, E as in Echo. Mr. Chairman, just to briefly remind the committee and the public, this is a bill about reimbursement rates for health care providers that come to them through insurance rates. Now, the first version of the bill you heard actually established a 75th percentile and a 450% reimbursement rate based on Medicare reimbursement. Then we came back with another version that eliminated that 75th percentile and simply did the 450% of Medicare with a requirement that the insurance companies provide a network of providers that's diverse enough and numerous enough that citizens would have access to healthcare clinicians of their choice. The committee substitute before you today is version W. And this is a bill now that offers a reimbursement rate of 345% of Medicare's fee schedule. So this would set the minimum reimbursement rate at 345% to address the need to ensure a supply of clinicians. Right now, there's no minimum reimbursement rate. Just a reminder, we've talked about this before. Contracts with insurance companies, between insurance companies and clinicians, have been changed significantly, and now they're somewhere around the 165, 185% of Medicare reimbursement rates. This isn't enough to sustain a clinic. So this bill has modified that reimbursement rate down to 345%. It still is adequate to keep a primary care clinic open. Primary care being that general practitioner, that family practice clinician who is the doorway in to the healthcare system. It provides for periodic audits to make sure that the insurer is actually meeting that minimum reimbursement rate. It still includes network adequacy, which ensures access for citizens. The bill has the six geographic areas, divides the states into six geographic areas, and requires adequate access, which means that there's a hospital, nursing facility, mental health or substance abuse in each designated area, that there are physicians, physician assistants, nurse practitioners, all available to provide care under this insurance policy in the area. And it also applies to tribal health organizations. Each provider must have a physical location in the geographic area in order to meet the minimum network standards. So this network standard adequacy prevents a situation as has happened in the lower 48, where the insurance company had such a narrow network that really patients had no choice. There were only a few people that they could go to that accepted their insurance. This kind of narrow network plan is being is already enacted in the lower 48 in some places where it's inadequate. But the National Association of Insurance Commissioners has stated that network minimums, as is in this bill, are the most important thing a state can do to preserve a well-functioning health care and health insurance market in their state. So we would be essentially adopting the gold standard as recommended by the Insurance Commissioners National Organization. 38 states have policies such as is in this bill. So these two policies will go hand in hand to ensure that we have the health care providers being reimbursed at an adequate level and that there is enough diversity of health care providers in the various places around the state. Mr. Chairman, my staff, Jane Conway, can talk to you and go through the very few changes that are found in version W.
Thank you very much, Senator. Before we do that, we will put the CS officially before the committee. Members have a copy of that version W in their packets as a draft proposed committee substitute. May I have a motion, please?
Certainly. Mr. Chairman, I move to adopt committee substitute for Senate Bill 121, version 34, Lima Sierra 0282 /W Whiskey as a working document. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'll object for purposes of explanation. Ms. Conway.
Good afternoon. Good sunny afternoon to the committee. My name is Jane Conway, and I'm staff to Senator Kathy Geisel. So before you now, you have the CS for Senate Bill 121 version W, and we are moving from the last version, which was version G, and now we're going to new version W. The section one is about the minimum provider network standards, and there is no change to that section at all. Section two is the standards for settlement of health insurance claims. This is very same as version G, with the exception of on page four, line 24 of version W. It changes the minimum reimbursement rate from 450% to 345%. Of the Medicare fee schedule. Section 3 is the same as in the previous version. It repeals 2107-0203, and that language is no longer needed because of the addition of the network adequacy language in Section 1. Section 4 is the same transition language as in Version G, and the effective date does remain the same at January 1st, 2027. That's the new version W, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for the bill sponsor or staff? Hearing and seeing no questions at this time on the proposed CS, I will remove my objection. Is there further objection? Hearing and seeing none, committee substitute for Senate Bill 121, version 34, LS0282/W, as in Wrangle, is adopted as the working document. Any further comments or questions before we set the bill aside for a hearing at a future meeting? Senator Geisel.
No closing comments. Thank you for hearing the bill, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. At this time, we will set Senate Bill 121 aside for further consideration at a future meeting. We appreciate you being here today. We'll take a brief at ease while we set up for the next presentation. We're back on the record. It's 1:48 p.m. here in Belch Room 105, Senate Labor and Commerce, on a beautiful sunny afternoon. It's looking real good out there. We have a presentation today from the University of Alaska Fairbanks with us to speak about UAF's higher ed manifold. Is folks from the Engineering Alaska's industrial workforce. We have Dean Bill Schnabel and Kevin Alexander. Gentlemen, welcome. We're glad you're here. Please put yourselves on the record and begin your presentation.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the Labor and Commerce Committee. My name is Bill Schnabel. I serve as the Dean of the College of Engineering and Mines at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Committee. I am Kevin Alexander, and I serve as Dean of the Community and Technical College at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. So real quick about myself and my background, if you don't mind. I was educated at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. I'm a fourth-generation aircraft mechanic. Almost a lifelong Alaskan, brought to Alaska by my father, who was a Vietnam-era helicopter mechanic, did 26 years Army aviation. And so I have a strong appreciation for the trades, for a workforce background, and a deep appreciation for the education I got at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
And I was also a UAF graduate. I got my PhD at the University of Alaska Fairbanks and now have served as the dean of the college. And so what we have are two graduates of UAF here to talk about what UAF does with respect to workforce development. That is clearly on the minds of committee members, on the state, and us as well. The CTC, as well as engineering, we work together in workforce development as it pertains to Alaska's industries. And so that's kind of what we're going to focus on today as a few sectors of industry. So put together a brief introduction, probably things you in this committee already very much know, which starts after this slide. But this slide, so we work at UAF, right? And we oftentimes think about UAF as this place that has different campuses. We have one at the Trotheata campus on the Hill. We have CTC. We have campuses all over the state. We are a land, sea, and space grant institution. And so what that means for us is that, yes, we have all these things, but we have a very, very broad area of responsibility. We are a small state in terms of population, a huge state in terms of geography. And so the things that we do at the university need to reach across the geographies. It needs to reach all elements of the workforce. So by virtue of us being a land, sea, and space grant institution, it means we are moving in all of those spheres. We're thinking about the workforce in all of those spheres. And so as we're thinking about workforce, you know, when I put these slides together, I thought the workforce, we need a technical workforce in this state. UAF, that's part of our mission. And then there's a student pool. And the issue is stepping back and thinking, well, okay, that's fairly easy. We just go ahead and put that workforce together, provide it for the state. But as you well know, it's not quite that easy because workforce isn't a monolith. It's actually very, very diverse. There are different sectors that we have to work towards and supply. And there are different jobs in those different sectors that we have to supply. So it gets very complicated because the workforce needs are very complicated and very diverse for the state. We need people at all different levels. So not only that, but UAF itself and higher education in general is not monolithic. We have different programs. We have different colleges. Even in the colleges, we have different programs that serve different sectors. So CTC, CEM, those are two different colleges within UAF. And if we're going to service the workforce needs together, we need to be talking together. Then it gets further complicated in that the student pool is not monolithic. In fact, it's made up of potential students coming out of high school, potential students from the workforce, potential students that are transfers. They all have different interests. So for us as a university, coming together to think about how do we ensure that we are providing this state with the workforce they need. Suddenly, it's a very complicated, very complex issue. And so the challenge that we have at the university, who's kind of in the middle of this, is to identify workforce sectors, is to speak about workforce sectors, find pathways through our university to make sure that we're supplying those sectors, and find the students that, A, may be interested in this sector, or B, could be convinced to go into this sector because there are lots and lots of opportunities. So our grand challenge is to align the workforce needs, educational offerings, and student interests. And for those of you who have kids, aligning student interests to what the opportunities are is not always the easiest thing. There's a convincing sort of thing we have to do. But we believe we at UAF, and frankly at UA in general, are well up to the task. And one reason for that is because we have what we used to call a pipeline towards from student interest to the jobs. And what we're calling it now, at least what Kevin and I are calling it now, is the manifold, because it's not a pipeline. There are lots and lots of different directions that lots and lots of different ways that can get students into the workforce in the way that the workforce requires.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, a lot of the kind of envisioning of post-secondary education in general seems to be changing across the country as priorities shift, as in the state of Alaska, as our infrastructure priorities shift even harder towards critical minerals, oil and gas exploration, aviation, construction, with the infrastructure projects that look to be coming to the state now more than ever. It's not so much linear, as Bill said. It's not so much the pipeline anymore. And if I were to draw those slides, I'd have a lot more squiggles on it, because it's not even that simple. We have folks come into the university that are, I call them job changers. They got out of high school, they did something, and decided maybe they got a little bit moneyed up, they've got some life experience, they've decided, you know, I want to get into that sector. How do I do it? And depending on, well, really, no matter what level they're looking to get into that particular workforce sector, whatever level, UA and UAF especially serves that. So to go through the different levels of education throughout UAF, especially as it applies to these sectors, it still helps to think of it a little bit linear, at least in terms of kind of length of time of education. So the various levels that we offer, really from occupational endorsements, which we'd call an OEC, up through PhD. So it's OECs to PhDs at UAF. Our occupational endorsements, those are our shortest workforce credential. They're 9 to 30 credits. Then up from that is a certificate, often for trades classes or technical workforce programs. And then to the Associate of Applied Science degrees, Associate of Science degrees, and then the degrees that are housed in Bill's College.
Yeah. At CEM, we have the bachelor's degree, which is a four-year degree program. Most of our students that go into the bachelor's degree, many of them come straight out of high school or they transfer in. Our master's degrees are two-plus years generally. The sources and where those students originate is maybe they're coming in from out of state. Some of them are coming from from bachelor's programs from our own program. Some of them are coming from the workforce. So people that are already out working can come and get a master's sometimes while they're working. PhD students, and we have one PhD program in engineering. PhD students generally come in specifically for their PhD. Sometimes they'll come right out of the master's program. Oftentimes we are importing those students from out of state who tend to stick around in the state afterwards. So what we're hoping to do today is talk about just a few sectors, industry sectors, and some of the different things that we do in those industry sectors to add value, to bring students into the sectors.
Yeah, absolutely. And when we think about transportation in the state of Alaska, obviously with such our diverse geography, so many communities cut off from the road system, aviation is in many ways a lifeblood of the state of Alaska. So not surprisingly, UAF serves that sector very well. Starting with our airframe and power plant certificate, we have the only, I believe it's the only 12-month airframe and power plant certificate program in the country. Many programs are 12-month airframe plus 12-month power plant. We do them both in 12 months. Just to shorten that time to get people certified, we know how important aviation maintenance and aviation safety is in the state. Our unmanned aircraft operations occupational endorsement, the drone sector is exploding, as we know. In the state of Alaska, that's going to be even more important. There's the possibility of long-distance delivery with medicine, even groceries, things like that through unmanned aircraft at some point in our future. Those are going to be aircraft mechanics, and they're probably going to be commercial pilots. But we're working to serve that sector already.
And in the engineering side, we just recently, 2 years ago, began a aerospace engineering program. And that has blossomed very, very quickly. We are doubling the enrollments, our projected enrollments, that was from when we first started. And, that turns out that more out-of-state students, that is a program that is bringing students into the state. That is the our new program with the highest interest from out-of-state residents that want to come to Alaska, learn, and most of our graduates who graduate from UAF then stay into the state. And I know in-migration would be very, very helpful for the state. As talked about on an earlier slide, so these represent some of the programs we have. Generating student interest is important. So while we have the programs, doing things together outside of the curriculum is really important, is a really strong way to get potential students interested in higher education. And so some of the highlights, so we want to talk about some of the highlights that are associated with these sectors. And yeah.
Yeah, and this is an exciting project. So part of my personal mission within UAF is to help eliminate all options to all students, no matter where they're coming from. If they have all of their options, all their menu options available, then they can make the best decision for themselves, for their career, the most fulfilling future they can make for themselves. And they can achieve that through UAF. So trying to help spread that message to all students, really starting within UAF, but then outside of that, looking at collaborative projects where obviously Bill and I get along pretty well, but how do we mix those student populations and really get that kind of peer experiential learning throughout UAF? This is a great example, this DARPA heavy lift project. So this is a DARPA challenge that I think it opened up in November, December, to very rapidly design and build a heavy lift but small UAV, so 55 pounds or less, to try and increase the payload capacity of these aircraft. We have built a multidisciplinary design and build team at UAF consisting of engineering students from the College of Engineering and Mines and aviation maintenance students from the Community and Technical College to mix those hands-on skills with the design expertise, structural analysis of those two student populations. And that's the model of industry, and students getting to be involved in projects like that, again, starts to eliminate those different pathways and really elevates the skills of all students involved. So I hope to have more updates on this in the future. Our flyable aircraft is supposed to be has to be ready by May 1st, and the actual competition is now in August. So stay tuned for that.
Yeah. And again, this is something that our students are doing outside of class. They are doing it on their own time because they love the design and the build of aircraft. And we're competing with Boeing and other entities across the nation are joining this thing. So we're pretty excited that our team in Alaska will be competitive for it. A couple other things we're doing in the transportation realm is DOT is, of course, interested in getting more workers. And so they are funding something called, so we have a T3 program, Teaching Through Technology. And what that program does is it goes out and gets cohorts of students, generally from rural Alaska, sometimes from urban Alaska, to do things associated with getting them excited about working in the technical fields. And so DOT is working with the Alaska Workforce Alliance and T3 to put on, for example, STEAM Fests, maritime STEAM Fests in Southeast. And what that is because they're at the Alaska Marine Highway System is at, I think they're at 75% capacity. They need to hire 25% more people. They are really, really looking for maritime workers. So through the T3 program and the Alaska Workforce Alliance, we've been putting on these STEAM Fests, getting students from high school age students involved in maritime careers, interested in maritime careers. And that can stack up to certifications in maritime trades. DOT has also working with us, initiated a careers pathway program, which is in engineering, it's an internship program. And it's an internship program right after students' first year, right after their freshman year. And what it means is that we can, in order to entice students to come and get into civil engineering, for example, we can offer them internships right after their freshman year where they work with DOT, go to sites all over the state, and do some really cool stuff. So elements like that, being able to add elements like that to the college experience and even before the college experience, helps to generate that interest in this case, transportation sorts of work.
So a lot of these programs really stack. We really have a complement of stackable credentials, and I think the best example of that is in our construction management. There are classes here at University Southeast in the construction trades. We have construction trades classes and these occupational endorsements at UAF, and those build into our construction management AAS degree at UAF that then feeds into a bachelor's degree at UAA. That's been a wonderful statewide collaboration in partnership with the Association of General Contractors and is being very successful in really meeting those workforce needs at every level. And, of course, those then would also feed into our engineering degrees.
Yeah. So an example of what we're doing in the construction trades and engineering is 3D printing. So we have a new robot that 3D prints concrete, which for Alaska is pretty impressive because we are looking at how can we use local materials to 3D print structures. And, for example, there is one test structure that has been constructed out in Nome. Thinking about, okay, if we can use local materials, shipping is oftentimes what really costs a lot with respect to building. If we can use local materials and construct some and come up with a concrete mix that works using fly ash, using silt, whatnot, and then 3D print that, that could be a way forward for the construction industry. That is emerging technology, emerging ideas, but it is also an idea that really tends to stimulate students who are thinking about going into civil engineering, for example. Wow, we can really do some new stuff, some new inventions that matter for the state of Alaska. So having labs like this and activities like this outside of classroom, because we're doing research here, that is a big bonus.
So our energy workforce sector, especially focusing on oil and gas, this is another one where we hit it really well at multiple levels, I think. Our welding technology occupational endorsement at UAF CTC, and then kind of oil and gas and process specific, our instrumentation and automation technology certificate, then our industrial process operator, a.k.a. process technology AAS degree, leading right into our energy resource engineering degree.
Yeah, we just opened up last year, just initiated an energy resource engineering program. And so we've always had for many, many years petroleum engineering, bachelor's, master's, and a PhD. We still have the petroleum master's degree, and you can get a PhD in that. What we did for the at the bachelor's level is broaden that degree program, because what we're hearing from the students and industry is, yeah, a lot of students want to be involved in renewables, for instance, or they want to use some of the reservoir engineering for geothermal. And so what we've done with our what used to be our petroleum program is start bringing in renewables. And we work closely with industry, specifically with the oil and gas industry, to make sure that students who graduated from that program can still work in oil and gas if they so choose, but they can also work in renewables. And so that is just getting off the ground, and we're getting a lot of interest in that program.
Now, our industry partners are critically important to the university system for a number of reasons. Obviously, the ConocoPhillips gift recently to the UA system was fantastic. Conoco is UA's largest corporate sponsor and is indispensable not only in, of course, financial support in this case, but also in guiding curriculum, in helping with equipment donations in some cases, or just ensuring that alignment between what we're teaching in our labs and classrooms and what industry really needs. I believe we do really well in staying on top of that. We have industry advisory committees for nearly all of our technical programs so that we can keep up with the changing needs of the state of Alaska. And as important as that is, of course, the university system, as we know, relies on state funding. But really, it's an all-hands-on-deck approach, and that's been successful. And it's still working. I will say enrollments in these programs are rock steady. They're very, very good. And we're essentially like kind of at system capacity, I think, in a lot of the trades and workforce programs. But great partnerships with both the state of Alaska, of course, and our industry partners. That's helping us move the needle.
I have a question. So, Kevin, you mentioned that you're almost at capacity. What would it take? I mean, we have multiple projects coming to our state in the near future. Oil and gas continues to develop and grow. What would it take to increase capacity? What do we need to do?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Chair. I don't want to get in trouble. I don't want to say words like sizable capital investment, things like that. But I will say we're trying to find creative ways to increase our shop capacity. These programs are in person. They require specialized equipment. They also require specialized faculty. And kind of an emerging need is the difficulty in competing with private sector salaries for these industry experts to come in and teach the next generation. So there's a number of challenges there with physical space capacity and also, again, competition with private sector salaries.
Understood. So can you give us an idea maybe in another venue? I think it's interesting for this policy committee as well as the finance committee to have options and to be able to take under consideration and advisement what those options look like when we're talking about, okay, if we want to make investments in growing this type of technical workforce or another, what's the price tag for that, both in dollars and then maybe other things if you're looking at switching out expenditures within the university itself? We want to know what the opportunity cost is as well. And I think many of the legislature are open to having those conversations simply so we know what our options are when it comes to workforce development at the university level.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Chair. Absolutely. I'd love to have those conversations for sure.
Please continue.
So critical minerals, of course, mining has been ever-present in Alaska and is increasing in importance for sure. So a number of programs here that speak to that need. The mining mill operations occupational endorsement, and then the work being done at our mining and petroleum training service at our Delta Mine Training Center.
And, of course, we've had the mining engineering program for decades at UAF. It started off as a mining college back in 1917. The mining engineering program is still going strong. In fact, there is a bill in the U.S. Congress right now called the Mining Schools Act that we're closely following. Mining schools nation, the U.S. is recognizing that, that mining schools nationwide need to be bolstered. We need to get more student interest in it and so forth. So this Mining Schools Act is making its way through Congress right now. And we have students from all over the state, all over the world in our undergraduate and graduate mining programs.
And our Mining and Petroleum Training Service, that's another kind of like, pardon the pun, gem of the university's catalog. We operate in a literal underground mine outside of Delta where we do actual underground mining training with students. That is heavily industry supported. We have about a 85% employment rate after certification. These students are trained in rural heavy equipment operation, surface and underground mining, jackleg operation, all of the skills necessary, especially safety and also employment skills and life skills in managing their finances. A fantastic and unique program. It's been really good for the state of Alaska.
So a few years ago, the state provided economic development funds to the University of Alaska for in different topic areas. One of them was critical minerals. And we in INE used those funds to build a new critical minerals laboratory, which is and so we have a new LA ICP-MS, an instrument that will measure very small concentrations of critical minerals in various media. So that's kind of the core of this new laboratory. We are using that already, working with different mining companies, looking at components of their waste streams. We are planning for using it with a new project that we are just finishing up the paperwork on called CORE-CM. It's a DOE-funded project intended to help build the critical minerals industry here, and we'll use that laboratory as a means of figuring out different ways of processing minerals and making better use of the minerals that we have in the state of Alaska. So that laboratory is we're using it in association with our programs, but we're also using it for research and to help build the industry across the state. So we and this is my simple idea for, okay, well, this is what we need to do, getting down to it. So our approach is this. We need to understand what the workforce needs are. And we've been doing that, and we get information from the Department of Labor and so forth and trying to understand what is that workforce. And we as a university need to tune the manifold, which really for us means we need to make sure we are working together, we are communicating to one another, and we provide lots of different pathways such that students or potential students can get through the university system, learn what they need to learn, and then get out into the workforce in numbers and areas that make sense. Number three is to make it exciting. So not just have the programs, and the programs themselves need to be top tier, and they are, but also doing things outside of the curriculum to entice students to get into those programs. That's the general approach that we're working towards. And so with respect to critical minerals, there is a university budget request for ACMC, the Alaska Critical Minerals Collaborative out there. And so for that particular budget request, that would help us do these things in this fashion. One, the workforce itself, we need laborers, operators, technicians, geoscientists, miners, mineral processors, and innovators, right? We need the whole gamut of different people if we're going to build this critical minerals industry. And that's just on the technical side. There are a couple of So there is an ask for funding to support the ACMC. That would support this activity in two ways. One, it would serve that particular funding would fund PhD students, so innovators. Which helps our broader push for R1. But specific to critical minerals, it would also serve as funding to help us bring in this engines proposal with the National Science Foundation. So it would be attached. So if the state provides some amount of funding for the PhD students, that helps us bring in the engines proposal, which is a 10-year, $160 million project, economic development project with the National Science Foundation. And that program has a huge workforce development component to it. That program, would work with T3, which I described earlier, Alaska Resource Education, ANSEP, these successful entities that are already out there doing good work for workforce development at K through 12 level, that would bring those groups into the equation. They'd be developing dual credit programs between high schools and the university system. For the university system itself, it would help us develop critical minerals related curricula from the OE, from the occupational endorsements, all the way up through the PhD programs. Long story short, funding like that would help us to move our ball forward by making critical minerals exciting, bringing them into a well-tuned manifold at the university for whatever pathway makes sense, putting them out into the workforce, which the state needs.
Excellent. Senator Gray Jackson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your presentation. Can you explain exactly what a critical mineral is? Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Gray Jackson. Through the chair. Yes, so there is a list, and excuse me, there's a list of some say 54 minerals, some say different numbers of them, but what they are different elements that are very important to, they could be rare, they could be important to new technologies that are being developed across the nation. And so rare earths, the rare earths is a category of elements, and many people say rare earths are critical, and some people call them strategic minerals, but essentially they are minerals that are out there, tellurium, gallium, things that most of them end in that we don't have a lot of and that we need if we're going to develop new fighter jets and new iPhones and the technologies that are going to carry us forward. And so developing critical minerals in Alaska, understanding how to get more of them out of waste streams, even in mines that are already operating, those are minerals that are necessary for the strategic independence of our country, but also because they extend the life of mines. And so if we are able to figure out how can we get more critical minerals out of our existing mining operations or even going out and looking for different mining operations, that boosts our economy, that boosts the security of the nation. And is that fair?
Thank you. Thank you.
Are there any other questions from committee members? So I heard your ask to fund your requests. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. Are there any things that high school graduates need to know more of, understand better, or be able to do better that would help them be more successful in your programs?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Absolutely. So I taught an aviation maintenance program for 20 years. And that gave me – and it's a cohorted program. So every 12 months we get a new group of students of all age ranges but a fair amount out of high school. And unfortunately, I've seen a shift kind of away from academic skills. And the belief, I think, historically has been, well, if I'm going to work with my hands, reading comprehension is not that big of a deal, or math skills, not that big of a deal. And it's just not the case. Technicians reading technical manuals, communicating to customers, communicating to flight crews, and that's just one example. And I've heard this from all of our trades programs across the community and technical college, that a decrease in academic skills for the students coming into their programs has been extremely challenging. The university is trying to respond to that with a workforce tutor program funded through the TVEP program, trying to kind of bridge that gap and put that together. But I would say that's the biggest maybe misunderstanding for parents and students coming through high school, is that's a great opportunity to develop those academic skills no matter what you plan to do. Because even automotive mechanics are having trouble writing customer reports to the customer on their invoices and things like that. And that's feedback we get from employers as well. So thank you.
Very good. Thank you. So would it be safe to say then, if the state instituted some policies and procedures by which high school graduates could show that they have achieved proficiency in the statewide standards, and they might have like a special certification seal on their diploma that would encourage them to achieve higher educational academic standards, would you all support something like that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think anything we can do to incentivize students to really focus on their academic skills through high school, I think would be a good thing.
Yeah, very good. You should check out Senate Bill 209. It's a good bill.
Yes, sir.
All right. Any other questions from committee members? Hearing and seeing none. Gentlemen, thank you very much for the presentation today. It was very informative. Excellent. Any final thoughts, closing comments, remarks? Okay. Well, that concludes our business here today at Senate Labor and Commerce. Our next meeting will be on Friday, March 13th, when we will take up six bills. First up will be Senate Bill 35, Delivery Network Companies. Following that will be a first hearing on Senate Bill 252, UCC Secured Transactions and Electronic Records. Then we'll go into a second hearing on Virtual Currency Kiosks, Senate Bill 249. We'll hear HB 110, Social Work Licensure Compact, and House Joint Resolution 20, Hiring of Apprentices / Veterans. Under bills previously heard, as foretold on Monday, we have added Senate Bill 181, Employment Information Disclosure. It would be the data sharing bill brought to us by ICER. We are concluded with today's menu of items, and this means that we will adjourn at 2:26 p.m. Thank you all.